Product Not Yet Rated. Welcome to the Lost Pages of Norse Myth. I'm Jason Weiser, your narrator and host of the Myths and Legends podcast. Each month, join us as we reveal a missing page from the Prose Edda, an ancient tome that contains all of Norse myth. It's whispered that these lost pages tell the story of a god from a distant land and his young son as they embark on a perilous journey across the Norse realms. I present to you now the fourth lost page, the Dead Stonemason. Thor was barely winded as he climbed up the giant's heaving chest. This battle had hardly been won, from his perspective at least. With little effort, the giant was already on his back, staining the snow-covered mountains as blood seeped from his stomach. "One last chance, Jotun," Thor said sadistically. "Reveal the location of your home and leave this place alive." The Aesir, and Thor in particular, seethed with hatred for the giants. He had been seeking to invade Jotunheim for years, and was known to torture the giants that he came across in an effort to elicit the location of their kingdom. "You lie," the giant snapped back at him. "And even if you told the truth, I wouldn't tell you anything." Unfortunately, it seemed that word had gotten around that even those who broke under Thor's pressure, divulging information that surely endangered their families, would not survive. "Very well," the thunder god snarled. He swung his fabled hammer, Mjolnir, and finished the giant off, another casualty in his merciless campaign of destruction. The clanging of the hammer and chisel grew more harried as sunset drew near and the bitter winds of early winter intensified. Brick after flawless brick, the elder giant, Thalmor, kept working, unbothered by the falling darkness. Though none in the Nine Realms surpassed his knowledge of stone and masonry, Thalmor's task of completing a wall to guard Jotunheim remained nigh impossible. Thor's malevolent crusade was nearly at the Jotun's doorstep, but even at this breakneck pace, the master stonemason never sacrificed his product. Thalmor simply continued his work in darkness, calculating the most formidable angles for his bricks, and crafting them with a measured ringing of his venerated hammer and chisel. Constructing massive walls to surround the ornate structures of Jotunheim was the last-ditch effort of his people to protect their precious home. Thalmor knew the responsibility resting on his sore shoulders, but the fuel of peril can only push one so far. Taking just a short break, the elder giant's heavy breathing was loud enough to send colonies of bats scattering into the sky. He looked up at his progress. It was impressive, no doubt, but there was still so much more to do. Weary in body and mind, Thalmor knew the only way to complete the work, but it would mean convincing his son to help, and that was unlikely to go well. Hrimthor was a good son, but the last few years of constant masonry had put a strain on the relationship with his father. The young giant never embraced the craft, and seemed even less inclined as he grew older, whereas it had become an obsession of his father's. Thalmor had already asked his son for help with the wall, but the fact that he even had to ask was disconcerting. The giant's very existence was at stake. Hrimthor may not have refused outright, but he surely wasn't doing much work, instead insisting that he had the heart of a warrior. Each morning, Thalmor would assign Hrimthor a task. Each evening, Thalmor would check in to find not walls, but piles of crushed rock. The boy's endless combat practice was pushing them even farther behind. Enough was enough. Exhausted from the day and night labor, he came down the path near their home to find Hrimthor eating his evening meal outside by the fire. As usual, the boy's work went unfinished. More piles of Thalmor's magnificent bricks, broken. "My son," Thalmor quietly fumed, "your battle fantasies will be the end of us. Tomorrow, you must work on the wall." Hrimthor didn't even look up from his dinner. "You say our time is precious, yet you waste it," he muttered. "Excuse me?" Thalmor asked, though he had heard quite clearly. "You think a wall will stop the Aesir? Finish your wall. When they get through that, they'll still have to get through me," Hrimthor smirked. "Son, hubris is a deceptive beast," Thalmor sighed. "So foolish, inexperienced, arrogant." Thalmor's words were intended to be wise, but he lost control of them as they blended into an incomprehensible ramble. He forfeited his temper, too, as it grew to match his giant size. His lecture of unbridled frustration brewed up into a great storm, dispatching gale force winds down the mountain range and bending the forested plains of Midgard. The blast uprooted large patches of pine and birch, cracking open the earth and sending fissures of bare soil up the spine of the snow-dusted landscape. Though Hrimthyr had trained for battle, he had never seen it. His father's outburst left him frozen, if only for a moment. Strong indeed, Hrimthyr's weakness was knowing only one course of action. He landed a mighty strike on Thalmor's jaw. With the crack of its impact, the young giant instantly felt its wrongness. Thalmor was knocked back by the boy's aggression and fell to his own instincts, throttling Hrimthyr with his mason's hammer. The force, normally reserved for sculpted stone bricks, sent the boy flying into Thalmor's wall. It came crashing down upon him. The fall of these enormous blocks dispatched a massive wave of shame that washed over Thalmor as he realized what he had done. He rushed to his son, arms outstretched, begging the boy's forgiveness. Hrimthyr refused to even acknowledge his father. After dragging himself from the pile of stones, the boy scrambled off into the night. Thalmor wanted to follow him, but his legs would not budge. Paralyzed by utter grief, he shouted and sobbed as his legs seemed to take root in the quickly frosting earth beneath them. Thalmor's emotions eventually receded, and as they did, his legs regained feeling. He began a search for his son. Thalmor scoured Jotunheim, but came up empty-handed. Standing at the unfinished gates of the kingdom, he thought he could make out the colossal silhouette of Hrimthyr, far off in the distance of Midgard's forests. Although he knew better than to venture there, especially so late, Thalmor was desperate. He set off alone into the blackness, trying to do right by his son. The giant stonemason lumbered through Midgard's dark and twisted forests. As the night grew colder, snow squeaked beneath his calloused feet, only audible between the despairing calls for his son. His cries carried as far as the cold air coming down the mountain, but they did nothing to locate the young giant. These cries did, however, gain the attention of another one, lurking in the mysterious realm of men, Thor. The Thunder God smirked at his sudden luck. Here he was, just steps away from Jotunheim's famed builder, the one entrusted with protecting the realm that Thor sought to conquer. "Mason," Thor bellowed, catching the attention of the elder giant. "Shouldn't you be back in Jotunheim? Perhaps you can show me the way." Thalmor refused to speak to the Thunder God and simply nodded in acknowledgement. A choice of certain death, but one that would not reveal just how close Thor was to Jotunheim's unprotected gates. The Master Stonemason instead gripped his hammer and chisel, readying himself for the battle that he knew he could not win. The brutal conflict raged under the stars, with Thor taking out every last frustration on Thalmor. The giant stonemason held longer than most, but his stamina was waning as the fight drew on. Thalmor's hammer was designed for construction, not combat. The Thunder God seized on the Jotun's wariness, striking him with his own legendary hammer. Thalmor went down hard, falling on his own chisel and driving it straight through his skull. Thor, the great destroyer, had laid waste to Jotunheim's great builder, his body pinned to the cracked earth with his own tools. Thor would later boast that he had set it up this way, but the stonemason's corpse was positioned so perfectly that it couldn't have been planned. The massive giant's fall crushed a village known for worshipping the Vanir god Njord. Even better, his bloody body faced the mountains of Jotunheim, serving as an ominous warning to the giants. He hardly even celebrated this good fortune. Still prime with the adrenaline of combat, the vicious god screamed toward the long range of peaks with a clap of thunder. "I will find your home. I will destroy every last one of you." Hrimthyr spent the night sobbing in a cave high up in Jotunheim's mountains. When he returned home, his father was nowhere to be found. He frantically asked the giants in the kingdom, but could only glean that Thalmor was seen headed out to Midgard late last night. Hrimthir knew the father must have gone to Midgard to look for him, a perilous journey any time, let alone in the gloom of night. Anxious at this prospect, the young giant set off into the biting winter morning to find his father. The famed snowmason wasn't difficult to find. As he came upon his father's corpse, Hrimthir unleashed a scream that sent a shockwave through the land, shattering the freshly formed ice on Midgard's nearby lakes. His tears cascaded into pools around his father's body, creating new lakes and rivers that snaked around the elder stonemason's corpse in twists and tangles. His mind clouded, eclipsing all else with inescapable grief, and his tears blackened to match. From that day forward, he would cry only the color of a moonless night. Though Thor may have intended it as an ominous warning, the giant saw fit to leave Thalmor's body where it fell. The site became sacred to the Jotun, and other builders began the construction of a temple to protect the great stonemason's chisel, though this measure made the area even more enticing to intruders. Before the temple could be completed, the giants made the final decision to retreat to Jotunheim and beyond, never to be heard from again. But the stonemason's lifeless body remained. Its massive size changed the landscape of Midgard forever, adding another ridge of mountains around Caldera Lake. It lies there to this day, just to the northeast of Tyr's domed temple, an everlasting reminder of Thor's cruelty and the consequence of a son who dares betray his father. The fourth lost page has been revealed. See the stonemason's story brought to life on an ancient triptych by following God of War on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Keep listening now as we delve into the new score for God of War, a foundation for the game's epic feel, with composer Bear McCreary. Even before talking about the game, how did you get started on this? Like, how was the project pitched to you? Like, what grabbed your attention and made you want to be part of this?
I had worked with a lot of the Sony music team on a game called SOCOM 4 a few years ago. And particularly Keith Leary and Pete Scaturro from the music team called me in here a couple years ago. And I came in and we started chatting and they said, what do you know about Norse mythology? And I was like, I know a little bit. I remember a high school mythology class. And I said, well, you know, I play hurdy-gurdy, which is this sort of Northern European folk instrument. We started talking about other, you know, sort of ethnic instruments. And I kept looking at them going, why are we talking about this? And finally I was like, is this God of War? And they didn't say anything. But then I was like, it is. And then they confirmed, yes, it is. So it turns out that this was in a very early stage. Before the game had been greenlit, they were looking at some musical ideas to put against some gameplay. And essentially, I got to meet Corey. I got to meet them. It seemed like I was sort of the choice that they had discussed and wanted to bring in. And I was really excited about it. And I just love the God of War series. So, like, to me, it was just a no-brainer. Like, it was really an amazing opportunity to get involved in an epic fantasy narrative. It sort of checked all the boxes for me that a project can have.
So you were a fan of God of War before doing this?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
They brought you in really early then. How much did you know going into the project when you started?
I knew a substantial amount. I had a meeting with Corey where he pitched me the story. I don't recall if it was 3 hours long, but I feel like it was 3 hours. I felt like I was sitting around the campfire. Like we should have just had, like, you know, s'mores and hot cocoa because I was just like engaged with this story. Corey's an amazing storyteller. Mm-hmm. And really, I realized my relationship with him would be very much like my relationship with a filmmaker working on a film or a showrunner working on a show. This is a guy who understands story. So that was incredibly appealing to me. I understood the relationship between the father-son figure, the sort of major story arcs that were going to happen. And all of that was channeled into this sort of first round of music that I wrote that was very early. And in the direction and the inspiration was really to strip down God of War to the absolute essential narrative bits to the smallest we could possibly make it. And in many ways, from that initial demo, it was a matter of putting the sort of more muscular music and tones back into the score, because the initial goal was to see how small we could get it. And the answer was pretty small.
Can you describe that in more detail, like the smallest bits, or like what does that look like?
Well, it was interesting because I wrote a theme that I thought would be the Kratos theme. Mm-hmm. And it was very sad, melancholy, slow, lyrical. The ensemble for that initial demo was string quartet, nickel harpa, Hardinger fiddle, so some other sort of Northern European instruments, a couple percussion instruments. It was very, very, very stripped down. Truly the polar opposite of the sort of extreme muscular music for which the franchise was known. Okay. That was received really positively. Just to sort of see, yes, this story can support music of that type. Ultimately, we sort of all came to the conclusion that that particular theme wasn't going to work for Kratos. It was a fascinating experiment, but it didn't represent him as a whole character because it sort of ignored his past. However, gamers are going to hear that theme in exactly that rendition because I sort of put it aside. I wrote a new theme for Kratos, which is what was debuted at E3 last year, which is sort of what we now just call the main title or the main theme of the game. That was sort of conceived maybe 6 months into my work on the game. That initial concept of, you know, how small can we get it? How intimate can we get it? Gamers are actually going to hear that initial theme that I wrote with the demo because I used it to represent sort of a family theme for Kratos. So his relationship with his son and possibly even his relationship with another family member that isn't there. All of that is represented by this lyrical, sad, beautiful, intimate theme that I wrote as an initial experiment based on what Corey told me about the story.
Do you consider yourself a storyteller?
Absolutely. I mean, my experience as a composer is predominantly in film and television, though I grew up playing games. I love game music. The draw for me is the story. And writing hours and hours of action and stealth music is fun, but it's not what brings me into the story. I honestly don't know how to get into music other than through narrative. Okay. So when Corey told me this story, and as I said, it was not a 5-minute conversation. I'm listening to this like someone is telling me Lord of the Rings, you know? Mm-hmm. There's so many factions. There's so many reveals. There's so many relationships that are thematically related to each other. It was incredibly inspiring. And the first thing I did was I wrote themes for these different characters, for these different arcs, so that in the cinematics, you're hearing these themes presented in a very sort of deliberate way. When a character is on screen, you're hearing their theme. It's very old school in that way. But beyond that, the thematic elements are interwoven into the gameplay music. So conversations about how a combat cue or a stealth cue would work were really conversations about what are the character relationships that are in the subtext of this battle, which is really interesting to me. Yeah. It, you know, in a more old school approach, you would write music for different areas. But what we were really doing was writing music for different parts of this character arc. There's a relationship between Kratos and other characters that changes as the game evolves. It changes the way he thinks about them. It changes the way the player thinks about them. So incorporating that mood into the context of the combat and stealth music made it possible for me to really get into it and add what I hope will be layers of meaning for the player that are beyond just commenting on the circumstances that they find themselves in.
As the characters evolve over the game, does the music evolve as well?
Absolutely. That is my hope. The story is layered enough that there's a lot of opportunity for that. Oh, so as players are playing through the game, keep an ear out to the way themes are presented and then the way they evolve and the way they end up.
So I want to talk about the wider Norse setting. how did that influence the sound or the score for the game? And like, what was that instrument you were talking about in the beginning?
Yeah.
Like, what
is that? It was a tremendous influence. Mm-hmm. I mean, it influenced almost every decision that we made. There's a lot of Northern European folk instruments. I mentioned nickel harpa, hurdy-gurdy, Hardanger fiddle as the three predominant instruments that I relied on. They're all Nordic folk instruments. They are generally fiddle-like in texture, but they're not fiddles. They definitely have a unique timbre that is more medieval, more kind of Renaissance sounding. And that was a direction we wanted to go. Beyond that, there is a lot of choral writing in the score, and we went to great lengths to make sure that the choir was something unique. And the choir that players are going to hear is a choir that probably most of them have never heard before. They're called Skola Cantorum. They're based in Iceland. And they are singing in Old Norse. Now, the reason we use them is that Old Norse, when we were consulting with experts, is the closest living language is Icelandic. Okay. So we realized that we could get a choir in London or LA and try to teach them syllable by syllable how to speak this old language, which I've done in other projects, and it's painstaking. Oh, gosh, or we could just literally go to Iceland and they can read it. So the actual text that is being sung at all times is written by writers of the game for the scene in which it's being sung. And it's being sung in Old Norse, and it's being sung by an Icelandic choir in Iceland. And all of that combines to what I think is a really unique sound. It doesn't sound like a choir that you've heard before. That combined with the Nordic instrumentation and the more muscular orchestration that I chose that emphasized lower instruments and even lower voices, all of that gives it, I think, a sound that is unique. It sounds, my hope is that it sounds modern and contemporary, but also ancient and muscular and mythical and ultimately distinct.
You mentioned like Northern European music and Norse music and Scandinavian. What are like the chief characteristics of those? Like if you had to...
Sure.
I'm curious.
I spent a lot of time listening to this music, and in many ways, part of the challenge that I had was that popular Western culture, American music in particular, the way that it connected to Nordic and Northern European music is sort of bypassing or traveling through Celtic music.
Okay.
So that much of the musicality of the Northern European area sounds like Celtic music. Mm-hmm. And to the uninformed ear, I think it would just sound like Scottish folk music.
Yeah.
So, and I've done a lot of Scottish folk music in other projects. And so part of my challenge was I want to make sure it's not enough just to be technically correct, right? Mm-hmm. If I technically use Nordic folk music, but everyone playing the game thinks it sounds like Scottish folk music, you have a problem. You know what I mean? Like you're not doing your job. You're not taking the audience where they need to go. So that was sort of hurdle number one. So what I started doing is focusing on things that make that music distinct from Celtic music and American folk music. So things that didn't translate over. That's where the Hardanger fiddle, the nickel harpa were particularly useful, just as sounds they are unique. I also noticed, and I don't want to get too into the weeds, but there are some harmonic and melodic things that happen in this music that tend not to happen in Celtic and American folk music. And there's a thing called musical modes, which are essentially scales. And American folk music and Celtic music is always in a single mode, whether it's a pentatonic scale or just a major scale or minor or any of the other more exotic scales. It's always the same. And one of the things I noticed about Nordic folk music is that it would often mix modes. It would be for example, in a minor scale, the 6 and the 7 are flat, but But then at the end of a phrase, it would just make them natural, or it would raise them as if it was a major scale. Now, this gives the ending of these phrases this satisfaction where to the Western ear, you think, yes, that's where that wants to go. But it also sounds weird because it means that the mode is sort of changing, almost like gears on a bicycle changing when it shouldn't. Mm-hmm. So I just latched onto that big time. And in fact, this sort of family theme that I wrote very early on is a perfect example of this. I can even sing it like ba 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 is a modal melody. Ba da 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 ba da 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 ba da 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 da. That second to last note shouldn't be there.
Okay.
You know? So in a Scottish melody, it would go da 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 ha ha, not ha ha. So it's subtle, but to me, especially as I'm focusing on what makes this music distinct, it was like punching me in the teeth, right? Like, wow, where did that note come from? So in that melody that I just sang, like that is where that Nordic influence comes from. And so little things like that I find really fascinating, I think help root the score, definitely, I think, for the casual listener in Northern European realms. And I certainly hope that people who understand and know that music even better than I do will appreciate all the effort that I put in and that Sony Music put in and that all the players put in to make this as authentic as possible.
So yeah, how has the past of Kratos inspired the music, and how does it weave in with this current version or this new version?
Well, Kratos' past, as has always sort of been his defining characteristic, haunts him. And that is carried over into this new iteration of God of War. And that was one of the driving factors in our decision to not have the sad lyrical family theme be the only theme that represents him. So one of my first tasks after doing this initial conceptual sketch was to come up with a main theme for the game and ultimately a new theme for Kratos. And his past, you know, his sort of muscularity, his barely contained rage, all of that is interpreted, I think, in a new way with this new version of the character. He's older. He is wiser. You get the sense he's much more reluctant to sort of return to his older ways, and that influenced me in his theme, and that I wanted to make something that had a kind of chant-like mantra. I wanted something that in many contexts could function in a introspective and sort of subdued manner. And that's why I created this sort of three-note figure. Bum, 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 bum. And it just repeats. And in fact, in the new main title, it's the first thing you hear. I mean, it in many ways is sort of the most important thing in the theme. It's the most important part. There's a melody that kind of branches out from that, which is cool. And you hear that. But it was important to me that there'd be something really granular, really small, not in terms of its impact, but in terms of the number of notes, so that I can use it in these very brief, short contexts. I mean, at E3, when he steps out of the shadows, and you just hear bum, bum, bum. And I think even before you've heard that a lot, that simple figure has meaning. And I was excited about having something that could be a recurring motif, but that could be also used in these introspective ways, used in emotional ways, but also could be amped up into this really masculine, aggressive version. And so it's woven all throughout the game. I mean, really, I don't know how far you'll be able to get in the game without hearing some version of that. But that's exciting. I think it's a really useful piece of music in that way.
With games, music can sometimes act as like a trigger for a certain thing. And it seems like it's kind of a less like binary thing here. It seems to be much more woven into the game and nuanced.
Well, it is. And I'm very confident that we will achieve something pretty spectacular with this game. Every conversation I've had with Corey has been about theme and character, narrative arcs, motivations. Every conversation I have with the implementation team is about how can I make this work? How can I give you the assets that you need to make this a seamless experience? Make it so that you feel like you are playing a game where the music is responding to your motivation rather than telling you what's coming. And that's really, I think, the difference. In cinema, you have control of time. So with control of time, you can really get inside the audience's head. You are helping them respond to what they are seeing. With games, so often it's the opposite. It's like looking at a stoplight from far away. You hear music change before you are aware of something coming, which I think is a problem. I think it detracts from the experience. I think it makes music ultimately a sound effect. If it tells you that there's a boss coming up, or if it tells you someone's sneaking up on you, or if it tells you you just defeated the last enemy in a fight before you figure it out organically. And when you start hearing the same death cue over and over and over, it becomes like a thing taunting you, you know? I think all that's problematic, you know? Mm-hmm. And game music for a long time reached the point where what really mattered was the production value. And all of that stemmed from the mid-90s when it became possible to use fully recorded audio. Okay. And for about 15 years, that was great. But really, I think now we're at a time when that's not enough. I mean, all game music sounds great. Mm. It has to be implemented properly for it to work. And that's where I'm very fortunate, I think, to be working with a team with the skill level that Sony has. Because I am confident we're going to be able to deliver something pretty spectacular. And what I hope is that everything I just described and the effort I put into it and the effort that all the team put into it, you don't notice. I hope you don't notice it at all when you play the game. You should just play the game and just feel like the music is carrying you on this exhilarating emotional journey. And ideally, you won't even notice like, huh, I didn't hear like the same battle cue over and over and over again. And huh, the cinematics, almost all of the cinematics were scored. I mean, and really like that is just an example of things, attention to detail that Sony puts in.
Is that not common? Sorry.
It is not common. I mean, as a gamer, I can tell you I have a laser eye for this. I can spot, you know, the big cinematic in the beginning, the big one at the end, and so many in the middle where it's like, I know that cue. I recognize that cue. I've heard that cue before. So that's just a priority of assigning resources to that. I mean, we recorded as much music for the cinematics as you might on a normal game just for the entire game. Mm-hmm. You know, and then we did all of the implementable music, all the combat and stealth and stingers and all that stuff. So there was a huge amount of music in a narrative game of this type. And you know, I think that told me how seriously everybody was taking this. Everybody's taking this so seriously that here's a cinematic in the middle of the game that's got a revelation, but it's not earth-shattering. But if we just tracked in some music, there'd be some dramatic underscore. But if I write it, then this character's theme comes in. Then this character's theme comes in. Then they talk about this other character. You hear a hint of their theme. You can't edit that. That has to be custom written. So when you're paying attention to like even a dialogue scene in the middle of a level, chances are there is custom written music commenting on the subtext of that scene. I think that is amazing.
That is so
and as
cool.
as a gamer, I'm so excited thinking like, you know what? Probably no one is consciously going to notice this, but if I were playing this game and I didn't score it, I would notice. And that makes me happy. Like thinking, if I ever play a game where the cinematics are that detailed in their scoring, I would think, who did this? You guys, you guys are paying attention, you know, so I'm excited about that.
Man, that's awesome. I love how well it's woven in with the characters and the worlds. One of the cool things about Norse mythology is the different realms and everything like that.
Yeah.
How did you approach creating the musical themes for all the different realms?
My emphasis first and foremost was on character. So Corey and I discussed the possibility of creating radically different sounds for the different realms, which ultimately I think we decided would feel kind of gimmicky. If, for example, we go to another realm and suddenly it's all techno and synths and it sounds totally different. Yeah, it would sound different, but you would undermine the fabric of the story that we're telling. You would be undermining the story itself. So first and foremost, the character themes are the key to the game. Now, with that said, there are certain themes that pertain to certain realms narratively, especially one realm in particular, where it has narrative significance and there's a theme that is very closely associated with it. Now, do you only hear it in that realm? No. You hear it all throughout the game in the context of people discussing it, in the context of people thinking about it. It's guiding you so that it has a narrative theme associated with it, but it's not necessarily used when you are there. There are a couple other realms you go to that have very distinct elements in them. For example, there's one realm where I brought in a soloist that you're going to hear, and it sounds cool, but it sounds different. And the reason it sounds different is that the instrument is called a Mataoquin. It's Chinese. Okay. It has nothing to do with Norse mythology at all. The construction of the instrument is similar to a nickel harpa. It's not totally alien, but the performer is Chinese. It's a Chinese instrument, and we had him play in such a way that it evokes some of that region's instrumental practices. So in short, it just sounds weird and cool, you know, and you only hear it when you're in that environment. So I thought that was one subtle way of just saying when we go to a new environment, hey, this isn't the same place we were. We're in a different environment. And there was other places where I brought in instruments and sounds that I reserved specifically for certain realms. But I can say that by and large, my emphasis was on the character, not on the place.
How is scoring a video game different than scoring a movie or a TV series?
It's a really interesting question. And fundamentally, it isn't different. Especially the games that I tend to work on, or certainly all the games that I've worked on, are very narrative-based. They're story-driven. They're character-driven. If I were scoring a big fantasy series or fantasy movie trilogy about Norse mythology and it had all these factions, the themes that I wrote for that would be the same as I wrote for this. I mean, there's no difference in the generation of the material. The implementation is different, for sure. The production is different. The way you record and deliver is different. And I think the biggest difference really is the trust that you have to put into your dev team, your audio team. It's just a different relationship. When I send music over to a dub stage, I'll be able to go to that playback of the movie, watch it with the director, the mixers are there at the console, and we can all talk about dialing in the exact perfect experience, because that's what the goal is. With games, you don't have that experience. That's the thrill of it. There is no perfect experience. It's unique for the player. So handing over the materials to the development team and trusting in them, working with them and saying, hey, the version of my music that you're going to hear when you play the game is fundamentally different than the version that I composed. And it's going through the artistry of the people implementing it. That is different. And in that regard, I'm always very grateful to work with people that know what they're doing, people who want to know what my vision is, where we have mutual respect enough that I trust them to take my vision and deliver it and implement it in the game in such a way that it'll be cool. And my experiences, especially at Sony, have just been so stellar. So I'm very excited to hear how the implementation of God of War ends up. I've heard little bits of it, and it seems very promising. But that is different, truly, than a film or a TV show.
Well, this has been really cool. It's really kind of changed the way I'm going to think about music and games.
Awesome.
And I'm definitely going to be playing God of War with an ear out for what you've talked
about.
Well,
hopefully you'll be so wrapped up in the story and the gameplay, you'll forget to notice. But if you do notice, I hope you like it. And I guess the same goes for all the God of War fans out there, you know, who I just want to say have been so cool and have embraced my involvement and my contributions right from the get-go. I mean, I'm a fan of the series, and it, you know, I hope that shows, and I just can't wait for God of War fans to experience what I've done and what the whole Sony team here has done. I think it's really spectacular.